We're almost ready to finish up type checking, so let me do that. Let me reiterate something I mentioned earlier, namely, after I get done with the type checking, we'll get into code generation. And one of the things I'll provide you, which wasn't available for type checking, is a fairly detailed structure on how to organize your code generator. The issue here is that if you made minor errors in a design, it might be something that was just sufficient enough to make your entire compiler not work. Say you just messed up like an assignment, so all of a sudden no assignments work. So what happens instead is I have a fairly detailed design that'll say, if you're translating an if statement, here's the sort of code you want to generate, and here's where you're going to have to first take care of this, for example, evaluating the conditional, and then check the conditional to determine if it's true or false, and then generate the then part or the else part with branches and labels and all the rest. So I'll be giving examples of that, and what I'll do is I'll post Piazza later this week. Maybe I'll do it tomorrow during the exam or a little later. And you'll get a flavor of part one, what it's like, and then come a week from today, we'll have parts two and three available. And I'll actually go over those in class to sort of give you the design I have in mind. With that, I think we have about 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks left to do the last project. And I think that'll fall in place very nicely. Let me also mention, if you are at the point where your type checker is not fully functional and you say, done with it, had enough, the final tests will not have any errors in them. No syntax errors, no token errors, and no type errors. So that even if your type checker is incomplete, as long as it's enough that it's properly doing symbol table entries and the like, the fairly straightforward stuff, your code generator should still work properly. So it's the case that if your type checker is at the point where it's not finished, it doesn't matter. I mean, it should be finished to the best of your ability, but it won't impede code generation since it will only code generate correct programs. Just as we were ending last time, I was mentioning the fact that breaks and continues will have to be verified. Sorry. There, that sounds better, at least to me. So in a break or continue, what you need to do is verify that the identifier that's the label you're breaking or continuing is first declared, so you look it up. And then its kind should be visible label if it's accurate and correct. And if it's a hidden label, you issue a special error message saying, error, this break is illegal, it's not inside the body of the appropriate labeled loop. Phrase it again as you want, or look at our test cases and see how we phrased it. So that's both breaks and continues are type checked the same way. Returns have two different variations, and one of them is function returns, which means I have to return a value that the function is promising, or subprogram returns where I don't return anything at all. So in this particular case, the way we handle this is, we haven't quite got there yet, but when we handle methods, I'll set what amounts to a global reference to the current method that's being processed. If you think about real programs, virtually all the code in a real program is inside methods. In fact, the only thing not inside methods are fields, which are inside classes. And fields tend to be fairly simple, an identifier and a type, and maybe an initializer. So all the real business is inside methods. And that means when we're actually checking most code, it'd be nice to be able to know what method are we in. And in particular, the issue we have here is I see a return, and I say, am I in a return of a function, in which case there better be a value of the correct type there, or am I inside a subprogram which doesn't have a value, in which case I better be inside of a void method. And the way to check that then is to always have a field, what amounts to a global shared reference, that is called current method, or whatever you want. And that's the method that's currently active. If you're not inside of a method, for example, when you're doing fields, you can simply set that to null as an indication there is no current method. When you have that, then the issue of is there a return value or not is pretty simple. You can, of course, go to the return value and ask, are you null? If you're null, that means that you should be in a subprogram that returns a void. So the way you do it is you look up current method. That points you up to the guy you're currently in. You're in his body. Sounds kind of bad, you know, like a disease or something. You know, you're investigating the body like some of your products do. And in that particular case, you go up there and you've got the method name. So you can, go, of course, go to the type and say, are you the void type or not? Issue an error message or not? If the sub-expression is non-void, non-null, I should say, you type check him. He may have errors. And if he doesn't have errors, he'll return a type. You then go to current method and say, is this the appropriate type? If it is, fine and dandy. Otherwise, again, you see an error message. And finally, the two most complex, and you can tell that by all the junk I had to squeeze into that little tree, is type checking a method. So in this particular case, you're creating a method. So the kind is method, and the type is extracted from the type node. You check that the identifier is not already declared. Remember, this is in the context of no overloading. If you allow overloading, he may be declared, but it better be a method, and it better be a method that has the same return type as the guy you're currently looking at, in which case that's legal. You're going to now get a different set of parameters to append, or as was suggested by Mr. Carlson in the back, you could simply create two different signatures based on the fact that each method, if it's without error, will have a different number and or type or kind of parameters. Therefore, this business we were alluding to earlier could handle that. That's not the way I did it in my solution, but it certainly Mr. Carlson did it that way, and maybe some of you did, and that's fine. In that particular case, what you're saying is there's not one definition that's overloaded. Rather, there's two definitions which are similar in that they have the same method name, but different in the sense that what's inside the parens will differ. And each different type combination will have a different string. And therefore, when you look them up, you'd simply say, I type check them. It says, I want the method that has a single parameter of type integer. And you find them or you don't. And that means the call is either valid or not. And the other overloadings, like the second one here, are completely invisible. The way I did it is I had one method. And the reason I did that, to be quite honest, is an earlier version did not have overloading, and I wanted to do the minimum amount of work possible. So I had most of it working. I said, well, I'll graft onto this the notion of having extra parameter lists. But if I was doing it from scratch, what Mr. Carlson suggested is probably a pretty good idea. And again, when we learn about the Java Virtual Machine, their designers, which were very good designers, did a similar thing. So it's not a bad idea, and if you did it that way, that's excellent. So the way I'm suggesting then would be, if he's already declared, you go ahead and do the parameter checking, but you don't create an error message immediately. You type check number 5, says you type check the argument subtree. And what you could then do is, after this guy is type checked, either as part of the type checking or as a post pass after the checking, extract this information I showed about parameters. Let's see, we had it here. Yeah, this business I had here about list of parameters. So you'd extract the fact that, hey, I had two parameters declared, therefore I have to have two pairs. The pairs are a type and a kind. So the first one was integer scalar, the other one was Boolean array. Go ahead and extract that. And I would then add this to the symbol table information. So now I have my kind is a method, my type is my return type, and I have this auxiliary piece of information that says here are my arguments. If it's not overloading, it's one list of arguments, as in this example, just two. If it's overloaded, I have a list of parameters. And again, that sounds kind of complex, but in data structures, that's pretty routine. You can have a list of things, and one of the things that's handy to have is a list of lists. So in this particular case, you would extract the parameters, and if it's overloaded, check that the parameters don't match any of the previous definitions for M. If they do, then you have an erroneous multiple declaration. If they don't, then you simply add another list of parameters to the list you already have, extending the list's length by one, and now you have more alternatives when you go ahead and do a call. You then, overload it or not, type check the declarations, type check the statements, and I think we said previously we had, create a new scope. So we have a new scope. Notice the way this works is the parameters are treated as local to the scope. So when I declare method M, M is global. He's at the class level, but the parameters and all the other local declarations are all local to the body of a method, and therefore the scoping handles that. And type checking, I'm going to show for call node, notice we have another kind of node called function call node. And I always kind of teeter-totter between whether I should have done one or two nodes. The difference is a function call node is in the expression context, and that means it has to have a result type. When I call a function, its kind will always be value, and its type will be the declared type of the function. In the case of an ordinary call, a non-function call, it doesn't have any type or kind information because subprograms are called for their side effects, not to return a value, or at least directly. They might change some globals or something like that, or adjust some parameters if I happen to have reference parameters. So in this particular case, I look up the identifier. It better be a method. I then type check the argument subtree. Once they're type checked, each of those subtrees has a type and a kind. I can then go ahead and build the list of type and kind as equal to the length of the parameters. I can then go ahead and, in the case of unoverloaded methods, go ahead and look up how many parameters it expects. Its list length ought to be equal to my length. If so, I continue checking, otherwise error message. I then, value by value, as illustrated here, go ahead and say, okay, here's a case where I already have type checked this, and I created this list saying I had two parameters, one's a Boolean value, and the second is also a Boolean value. I then say the length of these two guys should be the same, they are, and then I check position by position. The first one fails because it's integer and I provided a Boolean, so I issue an error message, parameter one is of incorrect type. And I check the second, Boolean is Boolean, but one is an array and one is a value, that is a scalar value, and therefore the kind is wrong. And I issue a second message, error parameter two, in this case, scalar provided where array is expected or something like that. Usually in error message, it's not good to talk about things like kinds because although programmers know about types, they may not know about kind. That's sort of like an internal compiler jargon, and it's something which other people won't necessarily understand. So you want to phrase it in something a little more universally understandable. So in this particular case, that's how it's done. If I have overloading, it's really not that much different. I say I'm going to look at each list that the declaration has and check them to see if they match. At most, one will match. I know two can't match because I would have had an error message when the second declaration happened that I was trying to overload a parameter list that already was in use. So I'd say if one matches, done, it's valid. If I go through all the lists and none of them match, then I just issue an error message saying error parameters provided do not match the parameter declarations of any of the overloaded methods for whatever the guy's name is, any of the overloadings of that particular method. So we do the comparison and do the checks of kind and type, and ooh, that's it. Yeah, that's right. I think that's all I need to do for a call. So those are all the notes I had for type checking, and finally got done with them before midnight of tonight, so I told you about it. So you say, you didn't talk about it in class. But are there any remaining questions you have on either things I've covered or things I haven't and that are still bothering you? Okay, so now we're going to close the book on type checking. You're saying, gosh, good, thanks for that. But type checking is really one of those important things there that the more complex a language gets, the more important it is to try to explain to a user if something doesn't make sense, why, so that their understanding of what the program is going to do and what your understanding is are the same. So what I'll be talking about now is, I guess 9 was actually more about type checking, but we're actually now getting into code generation. And let me see if... So what I want to do now is, I was warned that not everybody in the class has a strong background in computer architecture, and I really don't need it. But I wanted to give a little bit of background into our point of view of what a computer is. And you say, oh gosh, you know, I use computers all the time. But it turns out people think of computers as way more complex than they fundamentally are. And what we're going to be talking about is a stored program computer. That's the standard model these days, by a guy named John von Neumann. And basically it happens before the kind of computers we knew about existed, and they started in the late 40s, early 50s, computers did exist, but they were an odd sort of computer in that computer programs were not represented the way they currently are. Does anybody know, in the way, way back, maybe you've been to the Computer Museum in California, how the old style programs were represented? They were actually represented as plug boards. If you've seen old movies where some of you talk to a telephone operator and says, no, you're calling Joe Smith, and they take a wire and shove it into a particular hole to make a connection, computers are actually programmed by having a plug board, sort of a grid of holes. And you put plugs that were jumper wires that would say, I want this connection to physically be connected with that. And you'd actually go into a room and they'd have a collection of programs which were prepared plug boards, maybe a foot, foot and a half square, with wires all over the place. And if anybody pulls those wires out, they're dead meat because that would screw up the program big time. And you would actually take the plug board and put it into a slot and connect it. And that's how you program the computer. That meant programs were hard to change, and they weren't very flexible and weren't very complex, to be quite honest. So the big step forward was the notion of having computers that were stored program. And let me review this a little bit for you. And again, if this is old hat to you, I apologize, but not everybody has had this overview, and it'll help you appreciate what we're doing a lot better. So a computer is really just two things. Admittedly, these two things are complex, but not complex in their logical operation, complex simply in their implementation. So the two things a computer are perhaps two things that you notice when you go and buy one. At least I do it when I spend my own money. When you're spending the company's money, say, give me the best that you have, and nothing's too good for me. And maybe they buy that, and maybe they don't. But a computer is essentially a memory, and particularly something called a RAM, a random access memory. And that essentially is a mechanism for storing a huge amount of information in a way that it's accessible very fast and in any pattern. So if you've ever, I don't know if they have here, but many organizations have mailboxes that are little cubby holes. Do we have something like this? Everybody have a little cubby hole that's, so you have 6,000 cubby holes or, wow. Okay, this is it. Except you have 5,000 or 6,000. A typical computer has billions of these little cubby holes. These cubby holes are what are called bytes, and each byte has an address. So instead of having your name on it, they have a certain number. When you buy a computer that has so much memory, what you're really saying is how big the cubby holes are. So, for example, this little guy, which is hardly the world's most expensive computer, has, believe it or not, 8 gigabytes of memory. Now, if there are any old-timers out here, doesn't it shock you when you hear 8 billion bytes of memory in a little old laptop? You understand it, but it doesn't seem right. One of the games people play, and I'm sure you'll play that with your children and grandchildren at some point, is most people say how hard they had it when they were a kid. Oh, gee, when I went to school, I had to walk 8 miles each way in the snow, and I didn't have shoes, and it was uphill both ways. And on the version for computer people is, my first computer was so inferior that it only had this and that. And one of the ways you can do it is by saying, your first computer, how much memory did it have? Now, does anybody here go back to 16-bit processors? That's when, and that means you had 65K of memory, or maybe 65K twice, one for data and one for memory. So that goes back pretty far. I go back, and I have the story of all stories. My first computer had 20 kilobytes of memory, period. Now, a good buffer is 100 times bigger than that these days. So, and your earliest computers had on the order of 10 or 20 memory locations. So, it went up and up, so we're up to gigabytes. But basically, every computer has a random access memory. And one of the things you do when you buy a computer is how much memory it has. And a good rule of thumb is the more memory you have, the better it is. So, certainly, whenever I buy a computer, I get as much memory as I can. And usually, after a while, I can get more, and that gives me an excuse to buy a new machine and write the old one off as a business expense. But beyond that, besides the memory, which is extremely flexible, and I'll talk more about that in a moment, we have something called an instruction processor, that is a CPU. Now, again, these can be extremely complex detail-wise, but logically, from our point of view, they're really quite simple. What makes them different is they run extremely fast. If you ever go and buy a computer and they quantify the processor by a speed, so example, I think my thing here is a 1.2 or a 1.3 gigahertz processor. Does that sound about right? Typical processors, 1 or 2 gigahertz? What that means is ideally, the hertz are cycles, and giga is billion. So say it's 1 gigahertz, 1 billion cycles. That means ideally, if I set my program up just right, it could be issuing and executing 1 billion instructions a second. And that's what really gives computers the power. The speed goes up and up. You can do more and more in an imperceivable amount of time. If you actually think about what happens when I do something as trivial as click a mouse, it does a huge amount of things just to figure out what that mouse click ought to mean to the appropriate program. But it's able to do that. Now, what we're going to have to do is write programs from scratch. We're going to write programs that run as if they own the entire computer. And that's one of the amazing things that we'll get into, is how can you, when you're first writing a program, not just write a program that works, but write a program that doesn't screw everybody else up. And it turns out that it seems like that's a possibility. You know, you have a program that is messing with data or going to places it shouldn't be going or all the rest. How can you stop doing that? There's a way that the architects have done that pretty much guarantees that, yes, your program may mess up, but there's no way it can mess up anything else that's running on the program, on your computer. And you may not be aware of it, but if you take a machine like this or others, Windows 7 has it too, they have something, some sort of process monitor, activity monitor or something, that shows you that's all that's running. And even if something is doing something as little as having mail in the background and this Adobe processor processing a slide, there's certainly dozens and probably hundreds of programs, processes running any given time. Many of them are doing housework, but it turns out those processes each run without interfering with me, and I'll be able to explain to you why. So it turns out that the model we have is we have a memory, gigabytes perhaps of it, and a processor. Now, the real power about memory is that it can store so many things. And again, this is one of the things that's hard to get your to wrap your mind around until you see how flexible it is. Everybody knows computers are number crunchers, so they can store numbers. But it's really more than that. They store integers, the kind of numbers that are basic. But they also can store something called fixed decimal. And old computers spent a lot of time with that. Fixed decimal are numbers that have a decimal point in it, da-da. So if, for example, you're doing business computing and you want to bill somebody, you might bill them for $1.23. Now, of course, your company doesn't do that. I think probably anything under 1,000, you just round off under noise or something. But it's able to have fractions. In fact, computers actually predate, in Great Britain, the transition that the British did from pounds, shillings, and pence into a decimal. If you've been to Britain recently, they have a decimal currency. But it didn't always that way. You know, if you read old, you watch old movies, or you watch Downton Abbey, right? You know, Simpsons something, you know, what's your bill? You know, it's pounds, 3 shillings, and 6 pence, something like that. And early computer programs in Great Britain actually had a number format that counted pounds, shillings, and pence. And they could do arithmetic in that. You know, you go buying something, and you buy something that's 13 shillings 6. And it would go in there, and all of a sudden, 13 shillings 6. Well, 6 and 6 is a shilling. That's 16. That's 17 shillings. And you get your bank statement like that back. So they can represent numbers in lots of ways. Another great example is floating point. Floating point is where you have numbers that have a fraction and an exponent, like 1.027e to the 23rd. And engineers and scientists use floating point a lot to do all sorts of engineering and scientific calculations. It's gotten to the point, I mentioned this previously, that major engineering firms like Boeing design airplanes totally with computers. They don't use wind tunnels anymore. They don't use test models. They pretty much design the thing and know its performance before they have to do any testing. And then, of course, they build the model and fly it to make sure that it really does fly. But it's gotten to that point where the number crunching is so good, they can tell you things like this huge plane, is it going to have the right amount of lift? Is it going to be stable? How well will it turn, et cetera? How big should the rudder be? How big should the ailerons be to turn it and all that. So it handles numbers really well. But as you're familiar with, computers can handle other things like music. Does anybody know how the idea of creating computer music came about? It's one of these odd stories, and it's odd enough that I believe it might actually be true. It came from Star Trek, believe it or not. What happened is you've all seen the old Star Trek where somebody goes to his cabin and says, computer, play, you know, the Brandenburg Concerto or you know, On Wisconsin, you know, if we happen to win the game instead of lose it or whatever. And it turns out that some engineers in Bell Labs in New Jersey thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool to have a computer play music? The real limitation in the early days was that music took up so much memory space and so much data that the computers of the time could barely handle it. Besides talking about my first computer memory, you can also talk about your first hard drive. Everybody remembers their first hard drive. And my first hard drive, other than floppies, which are kind of built in, was in terms of, I think, 200 or 300 megabytes. And that sounds about right. But now, a good rule of thumb, just thinking about music, is when I record MP3s, I typically say about 1 megabyte per minute. And this is a compressed format. So if I had 200 megabytes, I could have my entire disk filled with 200 minutes of music. And it turned out the earliest formats even were less efficient than that. I think, what was it? The early CDs would have about 600 or 700 gigabytes. No, megabytes, right? Yeah, megabytes. And they would take about 60 or 70 minutes. So that's about 10 megabytes per minute. Does anybody, by the way, know why it is that it's 60 or 70 minutes instead of not just 60 or 50 or 40? There's another story about this that, again, is screwy enough that it may be true. Yes, but it's not Philips, it's Japan. It turns out that the early ones, Philips did it in cooperation with Japanese. But the Japanese actually designed CDs. And at that time, one of the big trends in Japan was to listen to Beethoven's Ninth. That's the choral ones and situation. And that lasts about 70 minutes. And I guess to this day, one of the recreations in Japan is to go in a choral society and sing the final Ode to Joy, yeah, in probably English, but maybe Japanese, as part of a choral band. And that's considered, you know, a great, you know, exciting endeavor to do it. So they made the CD big enough that the Beethoven's Ninth, the Ode to Joy, could be released on the first releases of CDs. So crazy sort of things and designs. But really, if you think about music, basically it says, oh my God, how can they possibly store music in computer memories? Does anybody really know how music is stored in computer memories? It's remarkably simple. It's stereo, of course, so you have two channels. So each channel is what? Just a series of numbers. If you look at it, typically the rate at which the numbers are read is something like 40K, is that right? 40, 41K or something? Basically, people can listen to about 20 kilohertz. And you need to do double that to avoid aliasing of some sort. So it's about 44K. I think that's the sampling rate is 44K. That's it. And all they do is have a series of numbers. And what is it, about 16 bits, which would be 65K. And it's just a series of numbers that's saying how loud it is at this instant. So if you have the sound getting higher, the numbers get bigger, and the sound gets quieter, it gets smaller. And, you know, if you have harmony and all that, the sound merges together, and that's all it is. So you can do music on numbers. You can do images. What are images? They're simply pixels. You know all about that. Used to be the better the camera, the more pixels you had. That's pretty much played out. What are the pixels now? 20, 40, 60 megapixels? Lots and lots of pixels. Really good quality. And each pixel has three numbers because there's three colors. You know, three basic colors, and each color has a number saying how much of that it is. Now, what are the three colors? I always forget that. What are the three basic colors that you compose everything into? Red, green, and blue. Sounds good. Does anybody have a red, green, and blue flag? That means you could squish the flag and get any color you want, I guess. Anyway, you know that, and then some number. So it's kind of odd because if you go and look in something like HTML, and you see a background, it's a particular color, they don't say, oh, it's a pale blue, or it's a rose pink, or whatever it happens to be. Goldenrod yellow is what I was trying to think of. All it is a series of three numbers. Let's say it's got this much of one color, this much of another color, and that much of a third color, and that's your background. So again, just numbers. But the most important one, and the one I've been leading up to, is we actually store computer programs as numbers. And this is what I'm leading up to. And again, many of you know about this, not everybody does. And let me just show you about that, because this is the big innovation. Once you're able to do that, we could have computers build their own programs. And to some extent, that happens. That's what a compiler is. A compiler builds a program in a form a machine can execute based on our commands. That's what programming is all about. Our final stage is to say, these are the basic instructions, the basic commands that our machine has to execute to make something happen. But basically, memories don't care. That's the cool thing about it. When you think about a computer memory, it can have data like numbers, or it can have music, or it can have pictures, or it can have instructions. And in the old days, maybe some of you did it back when you programmed very basic programs, you could do nasty things like trying to execute data. That would have all kinds of fun effects. Or try to add two instructions as numbers. You know, instruction one and instruction two added together does not give you a good third instruction. It gives you chaos. But in the early days, it was possible. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Too much? Yeah. Too much talking and enough watching. So basically, the way our computer programs will operate is they'll be a word of computers. Typically, a word of computers is 4 bytes, 32 bits. So that's enough to store an integer or typically an instruction. If you heard about machines going to 64-bit processors situation, the parts of the instruction got bigger because they wanted to address more memory. But instructions have tended to stay at 32 bits per instruction. And some machines even have shorter instructions. It's a question of whether instructions are variable length or not. But basically, all the computer programs we're going to generate will be instructions that starts with typically about 1 byte. That's the name of an operation. There's a fixed number of operations. We'll talk about them in a minute. And then something that amounts to an address. Remember, we have that memory. And what programs will tend to do is do something with this address, like put something in that address or fetch something from it, or take something and add numbers together to form a new number, or compare two numbers to decide if they're greater or lesser or whatever. And that's all that our instructions will do. And when we get around to JVM, that's exactly what we'll be doing, is saying, if I want to do something, and we'll show you an example of a little bit of arithmetic operation on next slide, all we have to do is figure out the basic operations that we need to do. We'll have a program called an assembler. In our particular case, it's something named Jasmine. And it will go in and actually put the appropriate information in computer memory and tell the processor, the CPU, please start executing at this particular location. And as long as those instructions are correct, the program will run. And that's all a program is a special format of data that fits the instruction format being executed by this special device that says, I'm not going to consider these numbers, I'm going to consider these commands. And a command will be, here's an operation I demand you do, and here's an instruction that qualifies where that command is going to be done. So what sort of commands do we have? Some of them are simply load or stores. They'll say, fetch from this location a piece of data, or alternatively, store a piece of data into that memory location. That's how we remember the effect of a program. When a program is done, it may have memory full of data. And again, the data may be straightforward like numbers, but it can be very complex too. It might be, for example, if you have a very visually appealing sort of program where you don't just show numbers, you show graphs or colors or dials or something. I remember there was a product I saw a couple of visits back where you had some sort of very flexible medical monitor where a physician could say, I want the pulse rate and the blood and the temperature, and I want it this big and I want it here, and I want this thing to sound an alarm for a nurse if this limit occurs or whatever. Does anybody know the product I'm talking about? Does it actually exist? Or are they just BSing me? Whatever. So in this particular case, there actually are instructions that say this is how this image is going to be formed, bit by bit by bit. So we have loads and stores. We have computation instructions that say, let's add some data or subtract some data or compare some data. and transfer of control that says, I'm tired about executing this portion of a program, please go to another portion of a program. So the way, for example, an if statement works is it computes a Boolean value, true or false, typically 0 or 1. If it's true, that means I want to execute the then part. If it's false, I actually transfer control around the instructions for the then part and go to the else part. And we'll actually design code that does just that, that says this is what an if is. It conditionally evaluates a Boolean and conditionally executes one part or the other, but not both, because it's conditional. I don't do both. So given that sort of intuition, let's actually look at the sort of code and see if it's all fit. We'll start out. And it's actually going to turn out when you write your compiler and get it working, you're going to actually generate instructions not very dissimilar to what I'm showing. So we're going to show you how you would actually take a program like A gets 1, B gets 2, and C gets the sum of A plus B. Again, not a terribly exciting program, but it is a flavor of what you do in real programs. So the first thing a compiler does is say, hey, I own memory. And I'll get to that shortly. When you're writing a program, you own all of memory. And that's a pretty cool thing because that means you get to put things the way you want. I don't know where it is in one of the buildings I was touring around. They had an aerial photo of this site when it was still a farm. Is that photo still around? It was on the wall somewhere? What building is it in? I'd like to... In which one? Okay. So just think at the beginning there, all this land and the powers that be would say, there shall be Andromeda, and Andromeda did occur. And what's the next one? Borealis? There shall be Borealis, and there it occurred. Well, you're not going to be doing anything so grandiose, but you're going to be saying, I own memory. And conceptually, I'll show you that if you have a machine that has 8 gigabytes, you own 8 gigabytes of memory. And guess what? You can even have more. Situation. There's a way in computer architecture for a program to actually use more memory than you physically have. Why would that matter? Well, remember, you don't have just one program running. You have dozens or hundreds, and they all have to coexist. So think of having not just one or two roommates, but 100 roommates, all of whom are vectoring in the morning towards either the kitchen or the bathroom or both. And you're elbowing your way out. And you're, get out of here. I have to shave, or I have to use the commode or whatever it happens to be. Or, hey, I'm trying to fry eggs. No, you're not. I'm going to boil a pot of tea or whatever it is. So we're going to have a way that you can make the kitchen bigger. You say, Collie, I wish I had a bigger kitchen. And bingo, you can have it. And the machines do that for you. Sounds like magic, but it actually does exist, and it comes courtesy of some very bright computer scientists. So that's a little ahead of ourselves, but we'll get to there. So in this particular case, the very first thing the computer does is say, well, variables have to be stored in computer memory. That's all there is. So actually, the computer will choose where the memory goes. Now, again, how do we do this right? What if, for example, it says here, I'm going to choose location 100 for variable A. What happens if there's another program running on my computer right now? If my computer comes back, that is using location 100. Guess what? It doesn't matter. We set things up so that your program and my program can both use location 100 and run simultaneously and not step on each other's toes. That's really very fundamental. The earliest machines, that was not true, but it is true now. Come on, guy, come back to life. And come on, I'll explain how. But basically, what our compiler will do and all compilers do is figure out where to put the data in memory, assuming they owns all the memory that the computer has and maybe even more. So for simplicity, we'll simply use round numbers. I'm not saying you'd really use these numbers, but they're as good as any. So we'd say when A is going to be at location 100, B is going to be at location 200, and C is going to be at location 300. I'm wasting space, but I've got gigabytes of memory, so who cares, right? It's all mine. And we're going to start creating instructions, and we'll just put those at another location, namely 1,000. And what we'll do is I've written here in English what the commands do, but these are simply encoded as numbers. It might be an operation code of 007 means one operation, and 009 means another, and so on and so forth. So I'm writing them in English, and what this says is it's going to manipulate data, and it's going to have one particular spot where it can do computations. In early machines, that was called an accumulator. In more recent machines, it's called a register Or what we'll use in the JVM is something called an operand stack. That'll be a simply separate area of memory, actually implemented by the processor, that stores data pending operations on them. So the way I'll do an arithmetic operation is push data on the stack, command addition, and the data will disappear and the sum will be replaced by it. How's that done? That's done by the central processing unit that's the brains of the computer. So the way I'll do here is the first thing I want to do, recall, was say, let's see if I can get, is I want to get A gets 1. So what I'll do is I'll say load a constant, and my address will not be an address. In this case, it'll be a literal value. It'll be the value 1. It says load that constant onto the operand stack. I'll then have another instruction. Since these are typically 4 bytes long, the addresses will change by 4. So at address 1004, I have a store instruction, and it will say take that constant value on the stack and put it into memory at location 100. So all of a sudden, location 100 has the value 1. Didn't have that when I was started, but I've set it up by doing the assignment of 1. I then load constant 2 on the operand stack and say, please store that at location 200. Now I have 2 memory addresses properly initialized. So how do you initialize data, or what does it mean? It says take these bit patterns representing numbers and put them in the appropriate memory locations that the compiler has chosen for the variables. And you own the compiler, so you make the choice. It then says, I want to do C equals A plus B. So let's write that down here. And remember, I said before, and I'll say it again, that assignments really work backwards in that, although you see the C first, you really have to do the computation of A plus B before C is ever touched. So this thing is saying, compute me A plus B. How do I do that? Well, in this particular case, I'll load a variable from location 100. That's A. That goes on the operand stack. A stack can have things piled on top of it. It grows and shrinks depending on what's pushed and popped. I then say, load variable from location 200 onto the stack. So now the stack has two values on it, A and B, which we know are values 1 and 2. I then say, add two variables. Where does it get them? From the operand stack. Where does it put the result? Back on the operand stack. So two values get removed by the processor. It does the magic of computer addition and puts the sum, which we know to be 3, back on the stack so that I can use it further. And finally, I have a store variable that says take what's on the stack, remove it, and put it in location 300. So now all of a sudden location 300 has A plus B, which is 1 plus 2, which is 3. And again, I'll make this available as supplementary notes in a day or two. And you can copy this down, and when you get your compiler running, you can generate this exact same code sequence, and you'll do something very similar in terms of the code you generated. So what this was a little bit of overview, just for people who aren't super familiar with computer architecture, of where we're headed. So what we're going to do is, when we see variables, we're going to assign memory locations to them. And when we see instructions, we're going to figure out what instructions are appropriate. Now, there are various instruction sets available. The one we're going to be using is the one called the Java Virtual Machine, the JVM. And all Java programs use the JVM. It's a virtual machine in the sense that manufacturers like Intel do not build processors that directly process JVM. There have been some experiments with them, but they're not very widespread. They build something that implements a different instruction set. If you're into the business, it's the old infamous x86. And that's been around a long time and looks like it's going to stay around for a long time. But essentially, the x86 runs its own instructions to simulate these. From our point of view, it runs pretty efficiently, and it's a much simpler instruction set. So we're going to be doing the JVM. And now let's get on to a couple of issues now that I've set up the background. About how we solve a couple of problems that I promised you I'd address. One of them is really sort of a brilliant solution to a very significant problem. And that's namely, I know a modern computer is going to have lots of programs running simultaneously. You know, if you look at this sort of thing there, and besides running my slide, it has stuff up top, so My home base is Fitchburg, so it says it's currently 62 in Fitchburg. My battery's down to 70%. It's 7:31 p.m., and on and on. So when you write your program and somebody else writes one of these little processes or programs, what happens if you both decide to use the same area of memory? Typically, if they're running simultaneously, one program would step on another. And in the very early days, this happened, and it was a severe limitation to how many programs you could run simultaneously. But what happened is some very brilliant person, and I'm not sure if there's any one person given credit for designing this kind of virtual memory, designed something called virtual memory. And what virtual memory says is the memory location, the memory location that you think you're working with, my example, location 100 or 200 or 1,000, is not the actual physical memory that the computer will use to store your data. From your point of view, it doesn't matter exactly what the number is. It's as long as it's the case that the numbers are consistent. So what it does is create two pointers. One is called a start pointer, and the other is a limit pointer. And these are hardware registers that the computer has that it uses to actually implement your program. So what you do is you say, hey, I'm writing a program and it's going to need 10,000 bytes. Might need more, but 10,000 is a nice round number. So what it will do is say, okay, I'm going to give you the image of 10,000 bytes. And when you write your program, this is going to be addressed from 0 to 9999. And as far as you're concerned, you're going to say, I'm going to put something at location 100 or 1,000 or 2,000 up to my limit. What actually happens inside the computer is that whenever you talk about an address, say, give me the data at location 100, it goes in and adds the value in start and say in the real memory, the one that's actually implemented in our computer, you're going to start at perhaps location 1,000,000. And therefore, if you ask for address 100, it's actually 1,000,000 plus 100, and that's the data that's fetched. It has a limit register so that if you try to go beyond 10,000, you don't step on somebody else's data. It says, bad, bad, bad. You promised to only use 10,000 bytes. You use more. I'm going to trap you as an illegal program. You're trying to grab data that you're not allowed to have. So what this is how things work so that you're able to guarantee that your program does not sabotage anybody else's. You own these 10,000 bytes. You can do any kind of mayhem you want. But nobody else can look at your bytes, and you can't touch anybody else's bytes. Therefore, your program is pretty much isolated. And that's why one bad program does not automatically crash a system, unless it's the old style of blue screens that you used to have in some old Microsoft operating systems. I had the misfortune of using Microsoft ME, the Millennium Edition. And oh my God, I'm glad. But Windows has gotten much better. I think most of you use Windows 7, is that correct? And I assume that's a pretty solid system and a pretty reliable system. So the bad old days have kind of disappeared. So that's virtual memory. We're just going to know that exists. And that means when we write programs, we own as much memory as we want. And here's the really cool part. Not only do we own as much memory as we want, we can own memory beyond what really exists. And again, that sounds like it's impossible. That's one of these shams, the situation, you know, where you know, go in and buy this investment and it's guaranteed to double in a microsecond and, you know, everybody will be rich. But this is not a sham. And within limits, it works very effectively. And what I'm talking about for people who have heard about this is something called paging. And what happens is, instead of actually giving you a block of 10,000 bytes, you can have 10,000 bytes. You can actually have more bytes than that if you feel you need them. And what will happen is we'll go ahead and take your allocation and break it into segments called pages. Now, the size of pages, operating system dependent, is it like 4K, 8K, something like that, any operating system types here? Something like 4,000 or 8,000 bytes in length. Remember, we're talking about major memories. But what happens is not all these pieces are in memory simultaneously. And now I can start to answer a mystery that some of you may have had, and it's the famous luncheon mystery. That is, you go to lunch and you come back and you take your program, and it's a little sluggish when it first starts out. Have you ever noticed that you go and click something and it doesn't come back to life quite immediately? And you're wondering what's happened. What's happened is your program has become idle. And what happens is the operating system, when it sees a program that has a segment of memory that's idle, it actually removes it from main memory, and I'll just X these out, and stores them into a backing store, typically your hard drive. It used to be a spinning drive, now it's probably flash memory. And that's where the limitation comes in. If your program is too idle, a lot of it gets sucked out of computer memory so the memory can be used by some other active process. And when you say, oh, I want this guy to be alive, it takes time, particularly if you have spinning memory, which is slower than flash memory, to suck this data back from the spinning memory and put it back in memory in the right location. So because of this, what happens is you're actually allowed to pretend you have more memory than you actually have, because not all your memory is going to be loaded. If you think about it, that kind of makes sense. If you have a very large program, not all the programs running at the same time. It may be that if you're in one sort of component, say you're using Microsoft Office, at one stage all you're doing is typing in data. You're not doing the spelling checking. So the spelling checking, assuming you don't have the spelling check enabled instantaneously, is idle. It's removed from memory. Later on, you type the things and say, hey, it's time to spell check. You turn that on, the spell check code comes in, and it starts doing its thing. So because of virtual memory, you don't even have to tell a program typically how much memory you need. In the old days, you did. You have to say, hey, I'm writing a program, and I need 100,000 bytes or a million bytes or whatever. Typically, these days, we're going to write programs so that we actually act as if we own the whole memory. And what's going to happen is, because of paging, the parts of memory we don't use or the parts that are inactive will simply be removed from our current share. It's rather much like borrowing books from a library. You can borrow as many books as you care to, but if you're not using the book currently, they may ask that you return it, so somebody else who needs the book presently will have it. You can only be reading actively, what, two hands, two books maybe or something? I don't know. As many as that. So it's the same idea. You can have as much memory as you need as long as you're using it. If you're not using it, it'll be taken back from you, but returned when you need it. The cool part from our point of view is this is all automatic. But now we have two big advantages when we write programs. One, we don't have to worry about stepping on each other's toes. And two, we can pretend we had this huge amount of memory, which we probably won't need and won't use. And we can even ask for more memory than actually exists. That means I can write a program that acted as if it had 16 gigabytes available, when I only have 8 gigabytes on my whole machine. Clearly, I can't have 16 gigabytes filled when I only have 8 gigabytes of real memory. But all it'll do is kind of say some will be active and be in memory, others will be back in my hard drive, which in this case is a flash drive, but that's half a terabyte. So I could certainly have enough space there to put it. So those two advantages are what we have. And look at the advantages that this virtual memory allows. It allows multiple processes to run privately and not worrying about stepping each other's toes. I mean, it's the case that if the guy uses a lot of cycles, he may slow you down. If there's a real slow program, it may steal some of your time. That's not virtual. Time is real. But in terms of what's running, he can't mess you up by going in and saying, oh, some other stranger came in there and messed my program up. So that means if you are having a software review and say, oh, it's not my fault, some other process was running and it stepped on me, it may not sell. And as I said, paging can actually be used to give you the illusion of more memory than you have, and certainly more than your share of memory. Even if I have 8 gigabytes, if I have a couple hundred processes running, each one of those processes can't expect to have several gigabytes of its own private memory. But they can be written as if they did, and they'll share, and whoever's currently active will have the memory, whoever's currently inactive won't. And as the operating system switches between processes, memory traffic will occur. And if you ever look at some of your meters, they're about memory traffic and all, you can actually see some of that if you actually care to look for it. So that's a little bit of background of what the architects have given us. So what we're going to do is we're going to act like we were here on day one of the creation of this epic campus. We have nothing but open area. And what we're going to do is say, in memory, I've got to put things. I own it all. I'm going to put things wherever I want. And one of the things I have to put in is some data. And I'm going to have various ways of accessing data or data. One of them, the simplest, is static. And that means we have a fixed address. And it sort of may surprise you that not all data is handled that way. In the very earliest days, the example I showed you showed only static data. That means that I go ahead and say, I'm going to claim this little location. So whatever location here was chosen for Andromeda, he says, this is it. This is going to be Andromeda, and nobody else can have that. It's going to be this land. But I can choose some other. So I'm going to make a decision, and it's going to be there forever. Now, buildings tend to have that property, but other things can move around a little bit, and you know, maybe that'll happen. So there's static fixed addresses. And what are those used for? Well, they can be used for program code. It tends, typically, once a program is generated and it mentions some addresses, those addresses tend not to change. The reason for that, if they changed, then addresses which used to be valid may become invalid. And because of that, changing the location of programs is difficult to do. And what we'll typically do is when we generate a program, it'll actually go into memory at a particular fixed location and stay there for the life of the program. That's not terrible because remember we have paging. If I have this bit of program and nobody's using it, it'll simply be flushed out of my main memory and into the original image of the program back on my hard drive. So parts of a program that aren't used can still be there just in case. And you probably have things like that too, some sort of rarely used code that are used for emergencies, or maybe there's some sort of internal panic or something and say, hey, something crazy happened, let's go in there and capture the data and send it back to a developer to figure out what went wrong. So those sort of things would exist. We'd also have them for data literals. That is, if I create a constant like 3.14159, it'll be the case that since that number rarely changes, it'll stay in memory at a location all the time. And whenever I have to view this approximation of pi, it'll be at a location where it's known to be and known not to be changed. Global variables are variables that are accessible to everyone in the program, all parts of the program. Those tend to have fixed addresses. Since any program part can talk about it, it better be the case they're consistent about where it's located. And finally, if you're a C programmer, there's some things called static variables. Static variables are variables that look like they're local to a particular block or a particular procedure or function, but they retain their value across calls. And in Java terminology, they're static data. And oops, sorry about that. And okay, it's just time. I just saw there to take a break. So what we'll do is we're talking about static. We'll take a break about 15 minutes, and I'll talk about more flexible data structures that you may not even have known existed, but actually have to be supported by programming languages. And those are so-called stack and heap allocations. So in this case, let's take a break of about 15 minutes. We'll pick it up at 8 o'clock, do a half-hour segment, and then we'll be done for the night.